Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
If you had been a Martian visiting the Earth from outer space in the year 900 or 1000 AD, and if you had then been asked to pick a region of the world that you thought might rise to the position of dominant global superpower over the next six centuries, chances are you would have picked either the Song Dynasty in China or the Abbasid Caliphate, a Muslim political dynasty that stretched roughly from modern-day Pakistan across the Arabian Peninsula and then covered a significant portion of northern Africa. Your assessment as an outside observer would have been based not only on the vast territory of each of these empires, but also the general level of commerce and culture that each region exhibited. Europe, in contrast, would have appeared as a disorganized collection of motley principalities and fiefdoms, hardly unified in any political sense, and seemingly backwards in terms of its intellectual development. Nonetheless, had you bet on the Muslim Middle East over Christian Europe, you would have been disappointed. By the 17th century, Europe was on the verge of its age of discovery, and by the late 18th century, it would be Western Europe that would give rise to the Industrial Revolution, modern capitalism, and unparalleled levels of economic growth. So what happened? Why did Christian Europe become the dominant economic power of the past two centuries, and not the Muslim world? While many scholars turned their attention to finding these factors that led to European success, another set of researchers has sought to explain the relative stagnation of Muslim economies. To what extent, if any, does religion play in this story? To investigate this question, I am joined today by Timur Kuran, professor of economics and political science, and the Gorder Family Professor of Islamic Studies at Duke University. Dr. Kuran is also the author of numerous articles and books, including Private Truths, Public Lies, The Social Consequences of Preference Falsification, Islam and Mammon, The Economic Predicaments of Islamism, and the forthcoming title, The Long Divergence, How Islamic Law Held Back the Middle East, which is due out in November from Princeton University Press. Timur, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for the invitation.
Before diving into today's main topic discussion, I really want to recommend one of your earlier books, Private Truths, Public Lies, which was probably one of my favorite, maybe top 10 favorite academic books of the past 20 or 30 years. And although it's not about religion per se, that work is filled with just a number of interesting insights that cover a broad range of territory, from the collapse of the Soviet Union to whether or not you leave a party late at night when you see other people around. So I in addition to having folks pick up your new book coming out in November, The Long Divergence, I really recommend that they pick up Private Truths and Public Lies as a package. So congratulations on all these books. They're great.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk about today's topic, and the question here is why, in relative or comparative terms, has the Middle East lagged in terms of economic development compared to Western Europe here? And let me begin by exploring the underlying supposition of that question. When I tend to think of the Middle East, I probably, like a number of our other listeners, tend to think of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, where they're building artificial islands in the sea because they have so much money floating around. What is the basis for the statement that, or the idea of the long divergence, by saying that the Middle East has been held back in terms of economic development relative to Western Europe?
Today, the region, when I say the Middle East, I am referring to the entire Arab world, including North Africa, plus Turkey and Iran. When you look at the Middle East, it appears economically underdeveloped with respect to Western Europe. More than half of the firms in the Middle East consider access to electricity and telecommunications and transport and other services a major obstacle to their business. In Western Europe, the comparable figure is around a quarter. in the region, life expectancy is about 8.5 years shorter than in high-income countries. That includes, of course, the West of Europe, but also parts of East Asia. Per capita income stands at about a quarter of the average for high-income countries. Only 4 out of 5 people in the Middle East, adults, are literate, as opposed to near complete literacy in the Western world. So all of these indices point to what we call economic underdevelopment. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the long divergence, that's the title of your book, and how do you define the long divergence? From whence does this begin, and when do we see major impacts of the difference between Western Europe and the Arab Middle East or the Muslim world?
So here's what the term refers to. If we go back 1,000 years to the start of the second millennium, around the year 1000, we would not notice any significant differences in living standards between the Middle East and Western Europe. Moreover, we would not notice that commerce, the way commerce was conducted, the way people borrowed and lent money, was significantly different between the two countries. Somebody who did business in Syria would find the ways of doing business in London or Paris quite familiar. Mm-hmm. Now, if we fast forward to the 19th century, a person that we pluck out of Damascus is doing business through traditional Middle Eastern means, and plop him in the middle of a stock exchange in London, he would be absolutely bewildered. He would also find the living standards to be much higher in London than in Damascus. So something happened between the year 1000 and the middle of the 19th century to cause the Middle East to fall behind. Evidently, major developments took place in Western Europe that did not take place in the Middle East. What I call the long divergence is the process by which, or the processes, I should say, through which institutions transformed themselves in Western Europe over many centuries to generate the modern economy, while at the same time the institutions of the Middle East, the economic institutions that were major determinants of living standards, of the way commerce was conducted, did not change appreciably between the year 1000 and the middle of the 19th century. That dual process, successive changes, transformations in Europe, coupled with institutional stagnation in the Middle East, led to a long divergence in institutions, so that by the time we got to the 19th century, the economic institutions of Western Europe looked very different from those of the Middle East, and that divergence, that institutional divergence, led in turn to a divergence in living standards. By the time we came to the 19th century, the Middle East was appreciably poorer than Western Europe.
Let me back up to the year 1000, and you had mentioned that the way that commerce was conducted in the Middle East was very similar to what it was in Europe. Could you describe how commerce would have been conducted about 1,000 years ago or so?
In both places, commerce involved pooling resources on the supply side. Mm-hmm. So you had merchants who, of course, used their own capital and operated on a very small scale. Those that wanted to operate on a larger scale had to obtain capital from others, typically people who had resources but did not want to do the physical work of commerce, carrying goods to a distant land, for example, themselves, so they invested in the activities of others. In both the Middle East and Western Europe, partnerships were used. that were set up for temporary purposes, usually for one trading mission that would last, say, 3 months. And they tended to be very small. By very small, I mean that the number of partners was typically two, sometimes three or four, rarely five or above. And they typically did not last more than 3-4 months, sometimes if the commerce involved carrying goods all the way to China or going to into Central Asia, they might last somewhat longer. But in all cases, when the trading mission was complete, the partnership came to an end. So in the year 1000, in neither the Middle East nor Western Europe, do we find companies engaged in commerce, or for that matter, in finance, that involved the pooling of resources by large numbers of people for long time periods. That is the key common element, and this is something that changes as we move forward in time.
So that's a key institutional change that we're talking about here. Essentially, the formation
institutional change that over time the scale of commerce, the scale of partnerships, of cooperation in commerce and finance rises in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. It stagnates in the Middle East.
So essentially we're essentially talking about the rise of corporations as well as corporate financial banking.
Well, this is the partnership was not doesn't have legal personality. So it's not a corporation. The corporation is part of the story, but it actually arises in the business corporation arises in Western Europe in the 16th century, late 16th century. Before that, we don't have corporations. We have growing partnerships. However, Western Europe was using the corporation already in the 10th century outside of commerce and finance. Cities were beginning to get organized as corporations. Guilds were organized as corporations, religious orders, and eventually, of course, the Roman Church declared itself a corporation. So the concept of a corporation was present in the legal system, which was not the case in the Middle East. Both the Middle East and Western Europe drew their legal systems partly from Roman law. Mm-hmm. The concept of a corporation was present in Roman law. Yet Western Europe borrowed it, the Middle East, even though the designers of Islamic law were familiar with the concept of a corporation, they did not bring it into Islamic law. So that eventually became, beginning in the 16th century, that became, that started contributing to the divergence.
Let me also ask a little bit, too, about outside of commerce and such, the differences in the year 1000 in terms of culture and scientific knowledge and learning in the Middle East relative to Europe and how that changed over the past couple centuries. What could you tell us about that?
In the Middle East in the year 1000 was not in any way behind Western Europe in science, or in level of education, or in literacy. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a controversy over whether the Middle East was ahead. The truth is that in certain areas, optics, metallurgy, navigation, a few others, the Middle East was clearly ahead in the sense that inventions made in the Middle East and that found practical applications had not yet been borrowed by Western Europe. In some cases, the inventions came from China or India and were adopted by the Middle East and only later by Western Europe. But there are some sectors in which the West was a little bit ahead, and others in which they were very similar. Something with which no serious scholar would disagree, is that the Middle East was not behind in terms of the content of education, in terms of knowledge of science, in terms of techniques used in business. I'm talking about the physical technologies mm-hmm. used in business.
And so let's go ahead and cover, before we get into the issue of religion or religious institutions, let's talk a little bit about how economists have viewed this puzzle over the past several decades studying it. What are some of the common explanations for this, what you call the long divergence, that might not be related to religion?
Well, there are three categories of explanations that people have offered with respect to the claim, with respect to the issue of whether religion is an important source of the divergence that we've observed. There's a category of scholars who argues that it has nothing to do with religion. They argue the fundamental sources of Islam do contain many economic prescriptions. None has constrained economic activity and therefore economic development in any measurable way. So they say if the Middle East fell behind the West, the reasons must lie outside of religion. One factor that they invoked is European imperialism. Mm-hmm. They argued that until the 18th century, the Middle East was not substantially behind economically in terms of standard of living Western Europe. Western Europe then started to colonize the Middle East, to gradually take over the administration of various Middle Eastern countries, and in the process, the Middle East fell behind. I have a problem with this argument. Not that I would deny that Europeans colonized the Middle East, not that I would argue that the Westerners were angels, that everything they did benefited the Middle East. I would argue, however, that the Europeans had been trying to colonize the Middle East earlier. The Crusades, after all, were launched to liberate the Holy Land from Muslims. They failed in the Middle Ages. If they succeeded in the 18th century and more substantially in the 19th century, it must be because the West had become stronger and the Middle East had become weaker. Mm-hmm. In fact, if we look at the whole history of the second millennium, we see that Western Europe's economic capacity and therefore its military capacity rises during that period, and that of the Middle East does not change or rises more slowly, and eventually it's the growing gap that allows, starting in the 18th century, the Middle East to take over the Middle East and to colonize much of it. So colonization is not the cause of the underdevelopment of the Middle East. Rather, it's one of the consequences of the process that we are trying to explain. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the explanations given, probably the most popular one, that does not involve religion, or that invokes factors outside of religion. Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the other ones that you talk about and or are arguing against here?
Well, another one is that is the argument that in the Middle East, the states suffocated economic development through policies that were inimical to the interests of commerce and private financiers and the private economic sector in general, and that they pursued arbitrary taxation, and that they did not promote property rights, because of the behavior of the states, remained weak in the Middle East, it is said, until the 19th century, and therefore the region fell behind. In Europe, it is said, the states gradually reduced arbitrary taxation, reduced confiscations, property rights became stronger, and so the difference has to do with the divergence that we're trying to explain has to do with different state policies. Mm-hmm. There's a problem here, which is that the policies of the state are endogenous to the system. They are something to be explained. They are influenced by the behaviors of non-state actors in society. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of, when we look at European history, we see plenty of arbitrary taxation, plenty of confiscations by rulers who were desperate during military campaigns when their domains were under a threat. We observe this in the Middle East as well. If the extent of arbitrary taxation diminished in one place and did not in the other, if property rights became stronger in one place and not the other, there must have been dynamics that were different. What was different is that in Europe, merchants and financiers, and non-state actors in general, what we would call NGOs today, they became stronger over time, and it's their growing strength that resulted in limits on what the state could do. It resulted in what we would call today democratic checks and balances. This is something that did not happen in the Middle East because non-state actors, whether we're talking about NGOs outside of commerce and finance or private economic enterprises and commerce and finance, they did not gain strength over time. So the checks and balances, the political checks and balances that emerged in Western Europe did not emerge in the Middle East. So the reason that the state policies remained problematic in the Middle East for much longer than in Western Europe has to do with developments outside of the state sector. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have to ask why. And when we ask why, in my opinion, we come back to religion. But I'll leave that until later.
Well, why don't we go ahead and pick that up now, because this is a really great transition to talk about these other...
Okay, now, so let's pick up from where we just left off. The private economic actors, non-state actors, become politically stronger in Western Europe, and this does not happen to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Well, one reason is that the concept of a corporation enters Western legal systems starting in the 8th century. Mm-hmm. And thousands of constituencies, ranging from states to guilds to various religious orders, many other groups organize themselves as corporations, and they gain the ability not only to run their own affairs on, at least on matters and internal matters, they gain internal autonomy as organizations, but they gain also the ability to act collectively on political matters. Mm-hmm. And so European states face, over time, growing numbers of collectivities that are well organized, that have a life apart from the life of their members. Cities continue even after their members die and are replaced by others. And this is what allows checks and balances to emerge. In the Middle East, Islamic law was the dominant legal system of the land. From the beginning, it spurned the concept of a corporation. It was influenced, as I said a moment ago, by Roman law. From Roman law, it borrowed the concept of the trust, mm-hmm. even as it spurned the concept of a corporation. So practically every activity that was organized through a corporation in Western Europe in the Middle Ages, in the Middle East, was organized through a trust. And the Islamic trust is called a waqf. So you went to any major city in the Middle East in the year 1400 or 1500, you would find a huge array of social services, fountains in every neighborhood that brought water. You would find schools, you'd find the mosques, you would find inns on the outskirts of the cities where merchants could stay for a nominal fee, you would find bathhouses and so on. All of these were organized by, were founded by wealthy people as Islamic trusts, as waqfs. The equivalent services were provided typically in Western Europe by corporations that were self-governing. The trust is not a self-governing organization. Its resources are used, the endowment that it has is used according to the deed established, filed in court by the founder. Mm-hmm. And in principle, forevermore, a trust, the endowment of a trust has to be used in the manner that the founder has determined and decided. Now, so that two implications. One is, if I could just mm-hmm. add two more things. One thing is that it led this this property of the trust led those established in the Middle East to become, in many cases, dysfunctional over time. As conditions changed, they could not reallocate their resources right. in the way self-governing corporations could. Secondly, the resources of the Islamic Trust could not be used toward political purposes, whereas there was no such restriction with respect to the corporations in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. So that, again, led to political checks and balances emerging in Western Europe, but not in the Middle East.
Oh, that's really interesting. I had thought of that connect. I can see how the issue of flexibility of the trust is a problem, that you can't adjust to circumstances over time.
Absolutely.
But the interest that the corporations could be used for political purposes, and when we think about that today, we oftentimes think about corporations that are rent-seeking or lobbying in Washington, D.C., but you know, back in the 1500s or 1600s, it provided a huge check upon the rapacious hand of dictators or kings in Europe.
Absolutely. You had thousands of cities that had corporate charters, and each of them was a political player. Mm-hmm. Every religious denomination was organized as a corporation. Monasteries were organized as corporations, and they were free to use their resources, sometimes in combination. Corporations could pool their resources, and this eventually strengthened what we call civil society, leading to various democratic checks and balances. This is something that we don't observe in the Middle East. One way in which religion,
right.
we started with the question of why the states remained arbitrary political rule remained the norm in the Middle East much longer than in Western Europe. When we ask why, we come back to religion, we come back to the difference between the legal systems in Western Europe, which had developed largely outside of the purview of the church,
mm-hmm.
and did allow the corporation, and the dominant legal system in the Middle East, which was based on religion, which was Islamic law, which spurned the concept of a corporation. So here we have one mechanism through which religion affects political development over the long run and also economic development.
Let me just ask a tangential question here, because we brought up the issue of monasteries, and I've always found that fairly interesting. I have to admit to being much more familiar with Christian Europe history than I Christian European history than I am with the Middle East. And monasteries were a very key part of the development of Christianity throughout the Middle Ages in Europe. Were there anything equivalent to monasteries in Islam in the Middle East at roughly the same period?
Not in the same way. You did have religious orders, Sufi orders that established homes where, or centers for people who shared their religious perspectives to congregate. There's some famous centers that go back to the Middle Ages that are still going strong today in places like Konya in Turkey. You did have them. They were far less important than in Western Europe. And in contrast to Western Europe, they did not play an important economic role.
Mm-hmm.
I know much less about the monasteries than I do about economic institutions and economic developments in the Middle East. But my understanding is that the monasteries did participate in some economic activities. They did lend money sometimes.
Right.
They did, correct me if I'm wrong, they did have farms. So they were part of the economy in a way that their equivalents in the much fewer in number in mm-hmm. the Middle East were not.
Yeah, that is true. The monasteries essentially became independent economic institutions. They tended to take vows of poverty, but also tended to produce things, beer being one of them, and farming and livestock and such. And as they became much more productive, they pooled a bunch of capital and became, you know, sources of financial wealth, which then, you know, actually acted as a check and balance on the Catholic Church itself. So,
yeah.
Which is interesting. Let's return to the issue of Islamic law here. And
yes.
So why is Islamic law spurning the corporation? And what role does Islamic law play, perhaps in other factors, in inhibiting the institutional change in the Middle East at this time?
Okay, there's some other factors that are very critical, and I'll come to that in a moment, but let me start with the first part of your question, which is why Islam spurned the concept of a corporation. As I said a moment ago, it's not because the concept was unknown. It was part of the concept of a corporation was available through Roman law, to which all of the early Muslim jurists had access to and were familiar with. Islam emerged not just as a religion, as something to meet spiritual needs, but also as a political project. Mm-hmm. Islam emerged in Arabia, in Western Arabia, a part of the world where in the 7th century, at the time that Islam emerged, the area was politically highly fragmented. There were hundreds of tribes that carried on endless feuds with each other, just wandering outside your beyond the confines of your areas controlled by your tribe, was to subject yourself to great danger. So there was a great need felt very widely for law and order.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the goals, immediate goals of Islam, was to unify Arabia and replace tribal brotherhoods, which had led to destructive feuds, with a religious brotherhood, a pan-tribal religious brotherhood. Therefore, institutions that would enable the tribes to strengthen themselves were left out of Islamic law.
Mm-hmm.
And the corporation, it was thought, could be used by tribes to govern themselves and to become political, to become strong political players. That is why the corporation was left out of Islamic law. In the Quran, there are two types of duties. There are duties, most of the duties that are laid out in the Quran are duties assigned to individuals, not even to families, to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are duties assigned to the entire community. There isn't a single duty that is assigned to a sub-community.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, consistent with the notion that Islam emerged with a political project, and the political project included the goal of discouraging factionalism.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the corporation was initially absent. Now, that doesn't explain, of course, why the corporation wasn't borrowed later on. The first laws of corporation in the Middle East were adopted in 1908, starting with Turkey and Egypt in the same year. Well, it's a long time from the 7th century all the way to the beginning of the 20th century. You would think that if the corporation was very useful, and it proved very useful in Western Europe in various spheres, including business starting in the 16th century and eventually banking, you would think that people would find it useful to import the idea, transplant the corporation to the Middle East. If that didn't happen, it must be because certain complementary institutions were absent. So that brings me to the second part of your question, and that is, were there other institutions, Islamic institutions, other components of Islamic law that played a role in keeping the Middle East backward? And I'm going to mention one that is central to Islam, and that is the inheritance system. It's central because the Quran spells out an inheritance system. And quite clearly, it's an inheritance system that, by medieval standards, is highly egalitarian. In the following sense, every child, son or daughter, is entitled to a share of an estate. It is not possible for a mother or father to disinherit a child. It is not possible for a mother or father to favor a child. Now, the Quran assigns a half share to each daughter,
mm-hmm.
But they do have a share, and the religion requires the child to receive, the daughter to receive a half share, and all the sons to receive a full share of the inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
The Islamic inheritance system also assigns shares to any surviving parent, to a surviving wife or wives,
mm-hmm.
of course, to a surviving husband, and in many cases also to secondary relatives, aunts, uncles, cousins, mm-hmm. Etc. Now, I'll draw a comparison here. The Bible does not state, lay out an inheritance system. Of course, in the Bible, there are many, many precepts that can be used to provide a Christian justification for this inheritance system or that inheritance system, but this is true for many different inheritance systems, and the consequence is that Europe developed many different inheritance systems. Mm-hmm. In an area as small as Moravia or Saxony, you could find at any given time, say in the 15th century, several different inheritance systems, all of which had a Christian justification for them. Mm-hmm. There was also change over time. Now, why did this matter? It mattered because the egalitarianism of the Islamic system, which has been praised precisely for that reason, because it was, by medieval standards, so egalitarian. Yes, daughters got the half share, half shares, whereas the sons got one share. There was discrimination against daughters.
But that was
the fact is that the daughters got a share, that the daughters did get something out of their parents' estate. Many alternative inheritance systems, for example, those of the Greek Orthodox, Jewish inheritance systems, and there are several variants of it. Many of the inheritance systems that emerged in Western Europe didn't give anything to daughters. Daughters had to be married off. If they couldn't be married off, they were allowed maintenance, mm-hmm. and defining what maintenance meant was left to the sons. In the Middle East, women did have more assets, and it was mandatory. The religion required that they have assets, and if the family didn't give them their shares, they went to court, and they made the court enforce the Islamic law. This was true all the way to the 19th century. Now, why does this matter to economic development? It matters because an egalitarian inheritance system will tend to fragment a successful business.
Right. It doesn't allow for any pooling of capital over time.
And it does not allow, exactly, it does not allow the accumulation of capital over time. We have examples of very successful businessmen in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. In Egypt, in Turkey, and various other places. In every single case, as far as we know, when they died, their capital, their business empire, dissipated within 10 years. Now, a contributing factor was to this dissipation of capital, to the inability to carry on a business after a successful businessman's life, was the marriage system. Mm-hmm. Polygyny was accepted by Islam. The Quran allows up to four wives. Of course, not every man had four wives. That was not possible. Very few men, in fact, had four wives, but those that did were either politically very powerful or economically very powerful, in other words, very rich. Mm-hmm. It was the very successful businessmen who had four wives, which meant that they had many more children than the less successful businessmen, and if they had many more children and more wives, when they died, having formed a business empire, they had many heirs.
And I can
so
just
one
see,
of the most,
see how this basically is going to dissipate the wealth even more. It's some
exactly.
It's going to
dissipate exactly, yeah. And it's precisely those successful businessmen, the successful businessmen that formed these big business empires, whom you would expect to be the source of institutional innovations. Because mm-hmm. As the scale of a business increases, as its longevity increases, as its life goes beyond the life of its founder, the sun takes over, and then there's another, somebody else that takes over, shares our soul to others. Various communication and coordination problems arise that lead to institutional innovations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this did not happen. These various institutional innovations that led to the modern economy did not happen here. Where did it happen? And I should point out, the footnote here, that it didn't happen in China or India either.
Mm-hmm.
Where again, you had similar problems. It did happen in Western Europe, which happened to have the most inegalitarian inheritance system,
mm-hmm.
at least among the many that were that came into being and that enjoyed benefited from a Christian justification. One of them was primogeniture.
Mm-hmm.
And primogeniture was the norm in the parts of Western Europe where ultimately the Industrial Revolution emerged.
That's interesting.
The Low Countries, England, Northern France, parts of Switzerland, a few other places, Scandinavia.
And
under primogeniture, the entire estate goes to the oldest son.
Right, so you're lucky if you were born first.
So you're lucky if you were born first, you get the business. Because you were born first, you serve an apprenticeship in the business. So when the father dies, and sometimes this came very suddenly the father developed a fever, you didn't have modern medicine, within 2 days he was gone, the son stepped in. And the son, because he'd been trained for this, he knew, he understood the business, he had the same contacts that his father had. He just carried on that business and then added. Started with a lot of capital and then added to it.
And that, I think that's
not, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an important aspect here of the economic development as well, and it helps to explain the long divergences that as the economies became more complex and innovations became more complex, you needed a larger pool of capital to actually fund some longer-term projects. It was probably fairly easy to do short-term projects with a small amount of capital, but you know, when you start talking later on with the steam engine and stuff, you need large pools of capital.
Absolutely, and before that, with the great explorations and the East India Company and these companies that undertook projects that would bring a return over many, many years, they required a lot of capital. And this was possible in Western Europe. And to go back to primogeniture, of course, this system is not so good for second sons, who are typically
right.
put into the ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Or third sons, which were typically put into the army, or for that matter, fourth sons. It wasn't good for daughters who were married off, and if they were lucky, they were married off into a well-to-do family, but they did not have economic rights themselves. But it did have one advantage. Primogeniture had one advantage, which is what you just touched on. It facilitates the... not only the accumulation of capital, but the forming of economic enterprises with long time horizons. And it facilitates economic planning, and if you can do that, then various institutions that we associate with a modern economy, that are critical to a modern economy, like stock markets, like double entry bookkeeping, modern accounting, like the business press, all of these are things, when you think about it, all of these are institutions that develop, that become useful,
mm-hmm.
and therefore get developed when you have large and long-living organizations.
Let me ask you, the need
doesn't arise when you're forming small organizations for... short time periods.
Yeah, basic commerce or small commerce
yeah.
and stuff. Let me ask you why that inheritance tax was put into Islamic law. Do we know much about why that innovation came in?
You know, we don't really know. Of course, people have speculated, but the farther back we go, the harder it is to find documents that would allow you to substantiate one explanation versus another. One thing we know is that the pre-Islamic empires in the Middle East, Assyrian, Babylonian, various others, they're the old states that were established in the region, all had highly egalitarian inheritance systems. And the historians of the period usually argue that the states put in place these inheritance systems because they wanted to discourage capital accumulation, because they felt that if families accumulated capital, they would form alternative sources of power. And so the Islamic inheritance system is similar, builds on principles that were already available in the region. What Islam added was rights for women. Mm-hmm. The older inheritance systems in the region divided estates equally among all sons, and in some cases all males, surviving males, which would include a surviving father, let us say, sometimes surviving male cousins, but they didn't provide shares to women. Islam started dividing, under Islam, estates started being divided even more because women started receiving shares.
I guess that's a great irony of it. You're providing, you know, equal opportunities, or at least more equal opportunities for women, yet this creates more dispersion of wealth and probably a component of randomness in there, because you don't know, you know, where the women will go marrying off or somewhere. So,
yes, yes, no, no, this is... this is something. So you ultimately, because of the inheritance system combined with the marriage system, which is also based on the fundamental sources of the religion, you unintentionally cause the private sector to stagnate. Mm-hmm. Enterprises do not become larger, they do not become longer lived. So by the time you get to the 19th century, you are competing, and businesses have become much larger and longer lived in Europe. By the time you get to that stage, you cannot compete in the global economy. You cannot compete with these through a legal system that allows only small scale enterprises. And that then leads to various secular reforms, mm-hmm. To the abrogation of Islamic law in various places, and the transplant of Western law. So, and the reason this happens in the 19th century is that the emergence of the modern technologies of mass production,
economies
and
of
mass transport, mm-hmm. and mass communications makes it absolutely clear that you cannot compete through the traditional legal system, through the Islamic legal system. Mm-hmm. It's and a huge demand arises from below for an alternative legal system. The you didn't have to have reforms in Western Europe, because the necessary institutions of the modern economy, the institutions that were essential for exploiting modern technologies of mass production and mass transport, emerged over 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. So by the time it became very useful to use large partnerships, the legal system had already allowed this. The legal system had generated stock markets in which that provided liquidity to people who put money in large and long-lived partnerships. Mm-hmm. The corporation became useful as modern technologies developed in business. the corporation was already available. The concept of the corporation was available. You just had to adapt it to business. But the entire legal system was very comfortable with the concept of legal personhood. All judges were familiar with cases in which one side was a flesh and bones individual and the other side was a corporation. Mm-hmm. This was not the case in the Middle East. You couldn't all of a sudden transplant the corporation and bring it into a system in the Middle East, say into the Ottoman Empire or Egypt, because judges were not familiar with companies that had legal personality. They were associated. They were familiar with disputes between individuals, not between an individual and a corporation, mm-hmm. let alone multiple corporations.
Let me ask.
So new courts had to be developed, and of course, this all of this compounded the delay of the Middle East. The Middle East delay in modernizing. It took several generations to transplant all these institutions that did not emerge over the past 1,000 years during what I call the long divergence. Mm-hmm. And we're still, the region is still playing catch up, mm-hmm. because these institutions became available quite late.
One of the other things I want to go on a bit of a tangent here, but I think it's related. And again, I haven't had a chance to read your book, The Long Divergence, for the listeners. It's coming out in November, and you can pre-order it on Amazon. And highly recommend it. But in terms of your book, Islam and Mammon, you made an interesting argument about communalism.
Yes.
And how commerce was organized in a much more communal manner in the Middle East as compared to Europe. And you know, in the time remaining, could you talk a little bit about that and how that also led to institutional innovations in the region? Because I found that argument just absolutely fascinating.
Yes, certainly. Now, communalism refers to contract enforcement through the community. Mm-hmm. The alternative is individualism, where individuals cannot count on their community for enforcing contracts. The difference in terms of long-term economic development between a communalist society and an individualist society is that in a communalist society, because your society helps you in enforcing contracts, in the sense that if somebody wrongs you, somebody breaches one of your contracts, everyone will turn against the person who breached your contract, mm-hmm. Making life very difficult for them. That person who breached the contract, your contract, will be ostracized, knowing that, of course, they won't breach the contract in the first place, or usually they won't breach it in the first place. Therefore, contracts are enforced quite well in a communalist society. In an individualist society, you can't count on your fellows. If you and I enter into a contract and I breach it, nobody's going to stop dealing with me. Nobody in the extreme, of course, in the pure case, nobody's going to stop dealing with me. I will have cheated you, and I'll go on doing business without suffering harm. Now, why this matters to economic development is that in an individualist society, the lack of communal contract enforcement mechanisms lead people to look for institutions that will do it instead of the community. Mm-hmm. So a legal system is developed, and courts are developed to adjudicate disputes. Various institutions are developed to monitor contract compliance. Complex organizations are developed to make sure that people are fulfilling their obligations. This does not happen in communalist societies. Now, the argument, and the argument is was developed initially by Avner Greif, mm-hmm. it's not my own argument, is that Middle Eastern societies in the Middle Ages were communalist, but West European societies were individualist. Mm-hmm. Now, I fully accept the argument and fully accept the notion that in communalist societies, contract enforcement is a lot easier than in individualist societies, and individualist societies will feel a need to develop modern institutions. The logic is clear. A problem that I have with the argument, and this is, I should say that research over the past decade has led me to this conclusion. It's not clear that if we go to the year 1000, that the Middle East was measurably more communalist than Western Europe. Mm. We know that eventually, if you come to the 15th, 16th century, there are signs that Western Europe is more individualist, and of course that's consistent with the development of development of various modern institutions, or at least the beginning of the development of modern institutions in Western Europe, and not the the Middle East. The question is when did the divergence in these attitudes, communalism versus individualism, when did that take place? Greif argues that already in the 10th century, the two regions differ in this respect, though he does not explain where the difference came from, what led to the difference. I am skeptical that already at that time there is an empirically identifiable difference in attitudes in these two societies. I think that it is something communalism and individualism develop in concert with the institutional changes of the sort that we have been been discussing. So I think that the starting point is institutions, and we can identify empirically differences in the 10th century or going back even several centuries earlier, differences in fundamental institutions, differences between the Bible and the Quran, differences between Islamic law and laws that are and the alternative legal systems in Western Europe. I think that is that provides us two different starting points. Communalism and individualism then develop as these different legal systems generate, or as the case may be, do not generate modern institutions.
Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. I have so many more questions to ask. I wanted to get around to the issue of prohibitions on interest, which are out there in Islamic law, but often circumvented, and issues such as that. But I think we're going to have to save that for another time. I've been talking with Timur Kuran here at Duke University. His forthcoming book is The Long Divergence, How Islamic Law Held Back the Middle East, coming out with Princeton University Press in November. And Timur, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.